This episode of the Western Outdoor News Podcast is brought to you by Abu Garcia. You don't need to be an Abu Garcia pro to fish like one, but you will need to be prepared for whatever nature throws your way. Bad weather, slow bites, and crowded waters are inevitable. One thing you don't have to worry about, your gear. Just like you, Abu Garcia rods and reels are built for the best days, but tough enough to make it through the worst ones too. They are an extension of the angler, with reels that cast further and recover line faster, rods that deliver power without sacrificing sensitivity. Abu Garcia gives anglers what they need to fish to win, whether they fish for fun or for a living. Visit abugarcia.com to see for yourself.
Top water obeys the laws of conservation of energy for big fish and obeys the laws of predator-prey relationships.
Hey folks, and welcome back to the Western Outdoor News Podcast. This is episode 32. This week we talk with professional angler Rick Klun, a name every bass fishing fan should be familiar with. Klun and I talk about his experience fishing the U.S. Open on Lake Mead.
Gun is to bite, and I've never been on before, and I've never been on since.
We discuss patterns of the past, as well as challenges Mead is known for, and new challenges present. We then sit and talk with contributor Nick Hyde.
Those are two points within a fight that you risk a hook spit or just a hook pull.
He discusses his recent column, Five Mistakes Every Surf Angler Should Avoid. Let's get this started with Rick Klun on the U.S. Open.
Your first U.S. Open was in 1981. Could you kind of recall that first year?
Yeah, it was really kind of a neat tournament because it was, I'd never experienced anything like it. I'd had 7 years of tournament experience all over, but not in out west. And of course, when the first time I drive out there, I immediately loved the wide open and the wildness of it and all of that. So when I got to the lake and saw how big it was, and back then too, really how untouched it was. You know, you had a few anglers, but not compared to nothing compared to where it was in the south, you know, as far as the amount of boats you'd see on the body of water. And so it was incredibly exciting because had such an open mind about what to do. I was a power fisherman, you know, most of my career, and a few fishermen I talked to out there, they didn't do that, the kind of stuff I was thinking about doing. So that was good. I was saying, wow, these fish ain't never seen what I'm fixing to throw at them. We stayed at Temple Bar a lot of Duke that first year of practice, and there were several guys staying there. I was real close with Gary Klein, and Greg Hines, and Rich Tobler, and all those guys were staying there. And of course, you know, we were kind of sharing the ideas, what they did, what we did. And the topwater by in July was something that I was real familiar with because I knew that was one of the best topwater times there was, the hotter the better. But that wasn't the majority way of thinking out there. But anyway, Greg and them, we started really doing well on Jerry Spooks and stuff like that. And I was throwing a little pop R. And of course, Greg and them kind of picked up on it. And Greg ended up winning that first one on pop on a spook. And then it's a pattern that really, and then, you know, the next year, everybody knew about it, throwing top waters. And then I think Rich Tobler won it again, throwing top waters the majority of the time. So it was kind of neat because of the sense that you were doing stuff that, and it obviously, when you do something new and it works, you really get on, you know, a bite that is really strong. And I felt it was real strong. But still, that lake wasn't easy. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't easy. But the real key out there has always been catching a few quality fish, and the top water then will do it for you.
Yeah. Now, when you first walked up to that water and you saw how clear it was, what was running through your mind with that topwater bite?
Well, I knew that was going to be, you know, really key because the senses that bass are using in real clear water, their dominant sense is not what I was used to. And in most of the southern waters where they don't have as much clarity, they use their sight, but it's not necessarily their dominant sense. But in real clear water like that, their dominant sense is sight. They're more like a trout in clear water. You know, you got to kind of match the hatch. And, of course, the top water was perfect for that because, you know, you didn't have much line in the water. You can make very long casts, which is necessary in the clear water. And plus, you know, to catch it, the whole key with topwater has always been to catch quality fish, because the topwater obeys the laws of conservation of energy for big fish and obeys the laws of predator-prey relationships. And so those laws were perfect for that, for that lake and that clear water, you know. And so, I mean, I was excited. And every year I was excited about trying to year. It's just a matter of time, and I'm going to win that tournament.
You have won this tournament, correct?
Yeah, 83 and 86. 83
and 86.
I became the first one to ever win it more than once.
Wow. And were there some key topwater bites during those tournaments?
Yeah, it was. 83 was pretty much all Pop-R back then. And, you know, and nobody had those baits because they'd been discontinued, and nobody knew how to fish them. It looked like a chugger, but you didn't fish it like a chugger. You fished it at a very high speed. So, and that's what the first 3 days I caught all my fish on, but I was still going to the final day, 13th place. And that was the first year the lake was ever full. And it's actually a little over full. I think it was 158 foot higher than it is right now. And me and Jerry, one day, we ran up to the Colorado River in practice, and we actually left the lake and went up into the lower part of the Grand Canyon. And we got kind of enthralled by some of these side pockets that were almost shut off by sandbars, but you could kind of run over into them. And we saw back in there, we actually waded over into them in practice, and we could see some really quality fish suspended in these salt cedars and in willow trees. But it was a long run. And so the first 3 days I stayed in the lake itself and throwing that Pop-R, and it was in 13th place. So I said, I've got to do something different the final day, because, you know, to catch up, because I was well behind. And so I said, I'm going to run up there where nobody's at. And so I ran way up that final day at the river and got on this bike that I'd never been on before and have never been on since. Up in that real muddy water with fish that were suspended in these salt cedars and willows. And I caught 2/5, which you know how hard that is to do on me in July and August.
Yeah.
And it was sight fishing. You'd see them barely, their backs barely under, because you couldn't see a bait a half inch deep. It was that muddy. But you'd see in these bushes, I actually noticed them jumping and chasing dragonflies when I got up there. And they would be in the very, very backs of these real muddy pockets off the Colorado River. And so I would move into those pockets. And I first couple of flips, when I see one in the bush, I'd drop it in there, and they wouldn't even let it get to the water. They'd jump out of the water and grab your worm about a foot out of the water. And I couldn't hook them. So I said, this ain't working. So I said, the next, I actually thought they were caught. There was two real big ones sitting in this one bush. And so I just pitched this little gator tail worm passing, swim it on the top like a snake. And all of a sudden, both of these big fish turned and came out at it, and one of them made it. It was one of my first 5-pounders. So that's the technique that I used. And I've never used that technique since. And of course, that area now is high and dry, real high and dry.
Yeah.
In fact, if you would go to, have you ever been to the Glass Bridge in the Havasupai Reservation there up in the lower part of the Grand Canyon, where you walk out and it's glass, you're looking down into the Grand Canyon?
I haven't, no.
Yeah. Would you walk out on there and you look down toward the lake, which is still a long way to the lake from there, I can see the canyons I was fishing in, even though they're dry now.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was kind of the neat thing. I ended up catching another 5-pounder that day, weighed right at 14 something, which, you know, is a huge string in July and August, and ended up winning. So it was really a neat way to win the first one, because, you know, the top water had been proven over the first 2 years there, and I made it work, but I could never get a good bite on it. And I knew that final day I had to do something different, and it worked.
Totally adapted to where you were in those canyons and fishing something that might have looked like a baby snake, like you're saying, just something totally different. Well, it sounds like there's always big hurdles at Mead. And the hurdles back then were huge runs, large expanses of water to cover before you got to where you wanted to fish. Now, fast forward, now we're looking at less and less water every year, this year being the lowest it's ever been. So what are going to be some of the hurdles this year, other than the obvious one that everyone's kind of worried about, is the launch in the morning? I think it's just another one of the hurdles that it's going to be tacked on to Lake Mead, as the giant it is.
Well, it is. And of course, even though it's, I think, somewhere around 30% capacity now, it's still a pretty big body of water. And so you still have to deal, and always at Lake Mead, number one thing back in July and August was the heat, but still, even that wasn't the number one thing. You had to deal with the potential of wind, because your equipment, might not survive it. In fact, the day that I ran all the way up in the lower part of the Grand Canyon, I had to go across Virgin Basin, which was pretty rough, and I busted my trolling motor, and I didn't know until I got way up there, which was over an hour run, and I put the trolling motor in the water, and it wouldn't work. But back then, I was smart enough to carry a spare trolling motor. I put it on the boat, but that's always the issue at Lake Mead, you can't underestimate the power of the water, because even if you make it to your spot, but you tore up your equipment, you're good as it. So will still be my number one concern there. Number two there is, and it's the beauty of Lake Mead, is she's always impartial. And she never quite will show you her true, herself. And there's so many lakes we fish in this country. If you're not fishing one or two of the right areas, you're not going to win, because those areas always historically, year after year, dominate. And also, if you don't do a certain technique, those techniques dominate and win. Mead's never been that way. She doesn't let you get away with that. Every year, you're going to have to refigure her out. And the area, you're going to have to refigure out. Because it can be won anywhere in Lake Mead. And it has been won pretty much anywhere, everywhere in Lake Mead. And so now you add the smallmouth to that. That's a different element that wasn't there. And of course, the one thing that's back then in the old days, it was really a lot different than now, was in the old days, it was a pro on pro. It was a four-day event, which is different, but the main thing is pro on pro. So if you draw a guy, it was always a big argument in flipping the coin whose boat you're going to take and where are you going to start at first. Now, at least you don't have to worry about that part. Back then, even though the fields now are huge, or the fields back then were huge, they were in the plus 200s.
Yep.
And so that's probably going to be the number one concern now in Mead is traffic. And the lake is going to be smaller, even though it's still a big lake. It's going to be smaller, and how you deal with traffic. Because I've known now for several years that the weather used to be the number one variable. But it's no longer. No matter where you go, weather is not the number one variable. It's number two. Fishing pressure is the number one. And so that's probably going to be, that variable is probably going to be the number one variable. You're going to have to figure out how to overcome. Because all the areas now will have, that will probably have a significant number of boats in them.
So the areas that you plan on fishing, you plan on there being some other guys in. It's gonna be that's gonna be the biggest thing this year, and has been, I'm sure, in the last few is just this pressure. Now with the lake being so low, do these fish seem to pull off the bank because of lack of cover, things like that? You're not gonna have any of the flooded timber and stuff. Do you see suspended fish being a huge part of this?
Yeah, especially with the smallmouth factoring in now. The thing, though, is that I think you as an angler have to realize it's, the lake is also new to the fish. And obviously, it's new to us. It's 12 feet approximately, I think, lower than 15 than it was last year when you had the event. And so that displaces the fish. That's a good thing for me. My way of thinking is that these fish have had to find a new home, and they're also being compressed into smaller and smaller areas, which means once you find fish, you should be more fish in that area because of the fact that they've had to move in smaller and smaller areas. In other words, this is hypothetically, let's say they were using a 15-foot deep rock pile last year, and now that rock pile is
an island.
Water. Now they've got to find another rock pile somewhere similar to that. Now, how far do they have to go to do that? There might be several in that area, so they didn't have to move very far. But at the same time, they may have moved very far. And the one thing that we've learned now, too, is that, and this is so true in Lake Mead, always has been low or high. The higher it gets off, this what I'm fixing to tell you, gets offset by the amount of habitat that's shallow. But now being lower, it's the same way with the lakes here at Taylor Rock. Why is it hard to catch big fish? No big fish live in that lake. Well, it's hard to catch big fish because the big fish don't stay on the bank except when they're spawning in Table Lake, in these clear water lakes. And so where do they go? Well, the worst thing is they go deep. But historically, on Lake Mead, deep dives did not catch the really big fish. If I look back on all my big fish, you know, and the guys around me, they didn't, the deep guys were just averaging 7 to 8 to 9 pounds a day. Okay, and so what happens in my, and this is just a theory, because I see it happening more and more in these clear water lakes in Missouri, which are kind of as clear at times as need, is they turn into stripers once they leave the spawning bed. And they pull the stripers. The bigger fish become nomadic. They don't hold one or two spots. Now, but one thing that changes that, which it is high, the brim and a lot of that were moving the bushes, and then the big fish were following, but it didn't high enough. So the food is doesn't have any place shallow to hide, so it's either all been eaten this shallow, unless it's crawfish, there's still a certain amount of them. So, but the main thing that meat is shad of some type, and they're out there roaming, and the stripers are chasing them. And the big fish are doing the same thing, licking the stripers. Their behavior is very striper-like. So, you know, electronics, we guys now are using electronics to really see that and give them a better shot at targeting those big fish that stay suspended 9 months out of the year.
And I'm sure the advancement of electronics has hugely changed the game, especially at these clear water reservoirs where fish suspend, correct?
Oh, yeah. The water column there, you know, well, I've always liked muddy water. If it's muddy, the zone the fish can be in, if the active fish is 1 to 5 foot.
Yeah.
You can't see a bait with, let's say, 6 inches. Your active fish are going to be 1 to 5 foot.
Yep.
So you don't have that huge zone that you've got to figure out where they're at and how to catch it. Immediately, it's clear like that, they can be 1 to 90. You know, so you've got a huge zone there that you've got to figure out where they're at.
Yep.
And that zone changes hourly during the day. So that's why that lake those clear lakes can be really hard, especially certain times of the year.
I could only imagine, you know, catching these fish suspended out over deep water, and I'm sure they're willing to eat top waters like you're talking.
Sometimes they are. Yeah. Depends on how deep they are. The problem is there is what fish is going to feed it to that top water. Most of the time it's the stripers. So that's the key, is being able to make a cast that you're not hooking up with stripers ever cast and taking up time and valuable time. You know, sometimes you'll hit it just right and you'll catch the largemouth or the smallmouth. But it's a hit and miss deal every day. So that's, you know, that can play a role, and this is for electronics is kind of helping. If you're good enough, and I know a few guys that are, I'm not, but I know a few guys that are that can look out there and say, those are stripers and those are bass.
Yeah.
And they won't throw at the stripers. And so so that gives them a little bit better shot at catching the bass versus the stripers.
Well, Rick, is there anything else you want to kind of add to Mead and its profile? It's definitely a mistress to be dealt with.
Yeah, it is. And that's the beauty of it. I've never seen so many lakes in one lake as Mead has been. And so many options. And if you work hard enough, you can catch fish pretty much anywhere you want to catch them out there.
Yep.
And now you don't get carried away that you're going to catch a lot of fish. But at the same time, and that's the other thing I like about me. And that's why I said in the Facebook video that they need to look at what I posted today, is that it will tell you how good you are. you can't lie about it. This lake is brutally honest. It will tell you how good you are. And that's why I actually fish it from time to time, even now at my age. And I'm changing my style so much right now. And Mead will tell me if I'm good enough. That's what I like about her. You know, she's not a pretend friend. Pretend friends are those that pretend to be a friend but talk behind your back. You know, I'd rather have a real enemy than a pretend friend. Now, Meat's not my enemy. I've had a affair with her for a long time. But she's not a pretend friend either. She's gonna be brutally honest about what you're doing.
When was the last time you were at the lake?
You know, and time flies by so fast for me now that I think it was probably the year I was third, Clifford Perch won it, the last time Clifford Perch won it.
Okay.
So I don't know what years there were, and I came out the following year after that, and I think that was the last time.
And you're for sure coming this year, right? We're going to see you out there. I'm excited.
And I would have been there a couple of years before this, but I've always had the elite circuit that I fish here. I've always had a conflict.
Yeah.
And especially with COVID. Last year, when you came to COVID, our tournaments into the fall.
And so it was
a conflict. And this year, I didn't have one. You may not have saw I didn't have one. I put it on the calendar.
Well, we're excited to have you again, and I'm hoping to get to meet you in person while we're out there, and I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a challenge, and I think this whole low water and people worrying about the launch ramp is just one more of those challenges.
Right. Now everybody has to get creative. I mean, that's what is, you know, that's what new courses you do, and it always has.
Yep, and we're working on things behind the scenes, obviously, trying to make sure that we figure out the logistics of everything, because we want you guys to have an experience as well.
Oh, yeah, no, we will.
Yep, all bets are off once the horn blows, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I can't wait.
Well, Rick, it was a pleasure talking to you, and hopefully we'll have you back on here after October talking about the tournament. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, that's
good. All right. Thank you, Rick, for your insight on this year's U.S. Open. And let's just roll right into it here with Nick talking about five mistakes every surf angler should avoid.
You had a little sidebar just a couple weeks back in the August 6th issue, and it was five mistakes every surf fisherman should avoid. And I kind of wanted to just kind of go into those with you and maybe get into a little more detail than you did in the paper. But it's a great way for people to kind of eliminate some things that they might be doing now that would help them with their surf fishing. So we'll just kind of go down the list here. Number one you talked about was setting the hook too soon.
For me, I've obviously seen and fished with a lot of people who, whether they haven't fished the surf much or they haven't fished in general much, I'll kind of coach them through it. And the angler that hits this one home is bass fishermen.
Yeah.
So it's always, I mean, their initial reaction is once they feel something there, it's up the mouth, out the lip, and it's gone. But for fishing the surf, it's a little different. I think barred surf perch is a really good example. So is the Corbina, because sometimes Corbina can hit and just they're on. But for the most part with perch and Corbina, you got to be a little bit patient on that hook set, because you'll feel, and I always describe it via sound, but it, to me, a bite will always feel something like either dit, 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 and that at that point the fish is nibbling at the bait, but it's not actually on, and it's not on until you feel that dit, 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 like three or four quick hits in a row, and you actually feel the weight of the fish and your rod tip will start to decently bend. And whether that, sometimes it just goes like a yellowfin croaker, you might just totally miss out on the dit, dit, and it'll just go dit, 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 and it's on. Those things hit like tanks, and the fight's not great, but they hit like tanks. But a lot of the times with perch and Corbina, and even spotfin sometimes, it's a very subtle, it hasn't decided whether it wants to take it yet. And you really got to be patient, because the other thing I'll say is if you keep proper tension the whole time you're soaking your sand crab, if you are more patient and you totally miss the hook set but you have proper tension, you're better off, it might hook itself, you're better off doing that than setting it too early, because if you set it too early and it hasn't had it in its mouth, you're going to miss it completely.
So explain the hook set then. You said multiple hook sets as number two. Explain your hook set.
Yeah, so the hook set, I would explain it as a quick wrist set. You don't need to rip into it like crazy. And it does depend on the rod you're using, whatever. Is it fast action? Is it slow action? Is it a light rod, a heavy rod, a medium rod. Once you feel it and it transitions to that and you feel your rod tip start to bend, it's almost like when you feel that rod tip start to bend and it's still there, if you can time it and set it, you kind of respond to the fish there. So if the fish is pulling your rod, you pull back just one steady, quick, kind of your hands in front of you and maybe bring it back a foot and just kind of set it firmly. And after you do that, whether you, sometimes it's not a perfect hook set, but after you do that, the biggest thing to do is keep tension and reel when you feel like it's going to give you line to pull. And if it's running, let it run. But you don't want to set it more than once, because if you envision a fight, your goal is to keep constant tension. When you let it get too slack or you pull too hard, those are two points within a fight that you risk a hook spit or just a hook pull. And if you analyze, like, what is a second hook set? A second hook set is just extreme slack to extreme tension. And if you look at that, you're just, if you do two or three of those, that's constant intermittent slack tension, and you're just begging for it to fall off. You get that one firm hook set, which is the hook is there in its mouth and you kind of set it literally into the side of its mouth. And then after that, rather than dipping down again and setting again, after you set that first one, you keep that tension, reel to regain whatever height you kind of put on the rod to get your rod back into a good fighting position. And after that, all you're doing is keeping proper tension the whole time.
So yeah, you're basically using the rod as a shock absorber at that point. Once the hook's been set, you just keep that tension and keep that rod bent and allow that fish to make his run or for you to gain line and just to keep the rod bent. That's, I think, very true across the board as far as, you know, seeing fish pull hook or even snapping line when you know, tension, no tension, essentially setting yourself up for failure.
Absolutely, yeah. And more often than not, like that's one of the tough things with people who get really excited. and you see it when people fight sharks too. So it's all
dropping the rod tip too fast, giving it slack.
Yeah.
I had a similar situation just a couple weeks ago on some bluefin with a customer.
Yeah. No, absolutely. The dropping it too fast before you reel is a pretty big one for sure.
Well, then you kind of go into talking about some of your gear and wrong reels, you know, reels to maybe avoid in situations.
Yeah, so with gear, really the one point to really think about is you're really only as good as you are, not your gear. So it's all about the angler. So you get your techniques down, but there are certain parts about gear that you should kind of think about. And the two main points that I kind of focused on was, is your drag functioning properly? Meaning when you pull that line or when a fish pulls that line, is it coming off in like bunches? Like, is it going zzzz? Like, you don't want that, because that usually means your drag's kind of freezing up. And when that happens, you've got uneven tension, really. So sometimes it'll go really, really tight, and the fish kind of, if it spits back and your drag doesn't give as much as you want it to give, you've got a point where the fish might pull the hook. And if it isn't stopping enough when you've tightened it to where you wanted it to, and it's just giving out way too much line, then you could create slack. So that's the main thing with the drag. And a lot of that is just keeping up on the maintenance and or getting a really high quality reel. And the other thing would be the anti-reverse, and I call it a perfect anti-reverse. I think it's referred to as an instant anti-reverse, but a lot of the cheaper reels that you might start out with, and there's no problem starting out with a cheap reel. Like I started out with, well, to be honest, I don't know the name of the rod that I really start out with, but the first cheap rod and reel that I remember is the Shakespeare Tiger. And I had that for a while. I caught yellowtail in a kayak in that thing. You take a look at the reel, and it's for sure, you crank it forward and it does what it's supposed to do. And then when you go to either stop it or set the hook, it actually is able to reverse a little bit before it stops, because it's kind of a big gear that has grooves that aren't super perfect. Whereas say the pen battle that I use is, it's kind of, I think it's called a, was it an anti-reverse washer?
The like anti-reverse bearing. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's the bearing. And that thing is, it only goes one way. So it doesn't allow any reverse, which when it comes to hook sets, it's huge because if you don't time your hook set properly, you know what can happen. So if you think you're going to time it properly and your reel kind of gives out on you, that's the risk there. And there are plenty of good reel options out there. I'm a big Penn fan, so the two that I'd recommend are the Battle and the Spinfisher. And I prefer anywhere from a 3500 to a 4000 series reel. But you can go, I'd be okay with going down to a 2500, no lower. And then I wouldn't go any higher than a 4000 for light tackle.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so having a good smooth drag system is definitely a key to being successful in the surf. You want to, like you said, you don't want that jerky drag to allow for tension to be lost. You know, and then kind of that just flows right into your line management as part of that, you know, not just relieving tension, but knowing where your line is while you're fishing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that one will actually, after the next point, I don't know if you saw, but this point, I kind of skipped over one big mistake that a lot of people make. But basically, in the surf, you've got a few things. You've got the surf, obviously. You've got wind, possibly. You've got current, seaweed, all sorts of things. So when you cast out, the best habit to get yourself in is as soon as your bait hits the water, manually flip that bail down. If you leave it open, you're going to allow more line to fall off the spool. And in doing so, that line is going to kind of sit on the water and even the water in front of you. And that water in front of you is the most directional, turbulent water there. So it's whether there's water, wind, seaweed, or just really high surf, whatever direction all that stuff is going in is going to pull your line in one direction or the other, causing a bunch of slack. So as soon as your bait hits the water, I'd recommend flip that bail down, raise that rod to gain tension or reel in to regain tension, and then you're good. You don't have to guesstimate, okay, how much do I need to reel in now because I see my line going left and then it's right and then it's left again and my bait, I don't know where it went anymore. So it's really just a good idea as soon as your bait hits the water. And it's not like a boat where you're casting out and you're like, okay, it's in the water, but it's got to drop 20 feet, so I got to keep it open. Here in the surf, when you throw your cast, there should be an arc on it that as soon as it hits the water, you can flip the bail because that arc will allow it, that slack you've created in your arc should allow it to hit the bottom without you pulling it back anymore. So I think that's the biggest thing there. But the other point I wanted to hit with that is what a lot of people get stuck doing is automatic bail flip.
One of my biggest pet peeves.
it takes a toll on the reel, and I've had to replace main gear after main gear. And after seeing, for the longest time, I didn't even know people did that because I'd never had that problem. But as soon as I started taking people out, and whether they're new to it or not, literally 85% of the people ballpark that I have taken out, they leave the bail open. One, when you leave the bail open, you're obviously letting line out. But two, when you crank into it and make it flip itself down like that, it's just, you can feel it mashing the gears in there. And it's
yeah,
just, it's
the wear and tear.
Yeah. Yeah. How many experiences have you had with that?
A lot. Like to the point where the reels wouldn't do it anymore, obviously. And mm-hmm. It was one thing during my, my fly line seminars while we were on the boat doing it with customers, even fish for calicos. Always flip the bail manually, you know, hold the line, let them eat it, you know, let go of the line, let them eat the bait, and then flip the bail with mm-hmm. your left hand or your right hand, whatever's, you know, not on the rod.
Yeah. And it's just, it almost gets, because you've got these people that they're paying you to take them out. You can't get frustrated with them, you know, and it's like, I could outline it. I do it every time. I outline it. I'm like, okay, this is what you got to do. And it's like, it's so ingrained in them that it's their habit. And as soon as they cast out and take their hand off their left hand off or the right hand off, whatever it might be, they just grab that reel and crank into it. And it's like, oh, I just told you not to do that. But Yeah, it's definitely, that's a painful one, especially when, like, every once in a while. So I've got my main rod, which I use the Okuma Solilo, and I've paired it with my Penn Battle. But for clients, I usually have the Pursuits, and nothing wrong with the Pursuits, but they are relatively cheaper. And for that reason, I usually keep the clients on those because they're reliable, but they're not crazy expensive. And these things have been through heck. But every once in a while, I'll be like, hey, so, I mean, I know you're looking into getting new gear. So you got this Penn Pursuit you've tried out. Here's the Battle with the Okuma. You'll have a different perspective. So now you can kind of figure out what you want when you go buy your own gear. And when I hand that off to them, I go over it twice more. Like, do not crank into this. You got to manually flip that bail. But yeah, and even so, I published an article on that on my own website, just the automatic bail flip. And it actually, like, every once in a while I'll share it on a Facebook group, and it spurred some like arguments. Like, people were like, I've been doing this for 50 years and my reels never had an issue. And it's, I think maybe the older model reels were made for that kind of stuff. But I actually had one guy who it looked like it was going to get into a heated argument, but he actually mentioned, like, oh, I'm going to go talk to Shimano's staff or whatever about this. And he got back to me and he's like, yeah, they said don't auto flip because it'll decrease the lifespan of your reel.
Yeah. And when you think about, like, the average angler going out there and using the reel compared to what you do when you're taking clients out and your reel's getting used maybe five times as often as any other angler, that's where the wear and tear really hits.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I guess the last but not the least is casting only far. A lot of guys, you see, they go for that big windup and they just let it rip outside the surf line. And it seems like they, you know, like, their agenda is to just cast as far as they can when they're fishing the surf.
Yeah. And that's one, I think, for any, really for the new anglers, because it's a lot of times, I mean, to be perfectly honest, for the longest time, I didn't even know you could fish from the surf. So when you do come to the realization that there are fish in the surf, you're not assuming that these fish are ankle deep, you know. So you I guess the first instinct is, okay, I got to get it further out there because that's where the fish are. But and realistically, you will catch fish out there. For certain types of fish, like obviously sharking, you want to throw it far. If I want really big guitar fish, I'll throw the biggest sand crab I can out as deep as I can and leave it out there with a three-way and a pyramid. Maybe some big spot fin, but at the same time, I've seen big guitar, big spot fin, big corvina beaching themselves. So it's just there should be a balance. Bottom line is, I think you should be fishing to the structure. So if the structure is short, you fish there. If the structure is far, you fish there. But by no means do you need to throw it out as far as you can to catch fish. So, and I'm sure you've had similar experiences. Even it, I don't know how much surf fishing experience have you had? I know we were talking about it last time.
I've a little bit. I used to do it. You know, I wasn't like an everyday guy, but mm-hmm. I was doing it once or twice a month back in high school and stuff. I would, you know, if I was going to the beach, I was usually bringing a rod.
Yeah. So. And your main, I vaguely recall you were into sight casting, no?
Yes, we were mostly sight casting. We were looking for the corvina, mm-hmm. You know, within inches of water and yeah. casting to them, mostly with lures, really. And that's where it's like, you know, that's where you really learn just by observation. You observe the conditions around you. You see that those fish are obviously in ankle deep water to where they're almost, you know, biting your toes sometimes.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And today was actually a perfect example. I had a client this morning and we had a decent day, and by weirdly enough, around like 8 or 9, when the sun was already kind of above us, is when I started to see a lot of fish in the shallows, and they were mostly guitar fish. But I have to control myself every once in a while because I just want to chill there and wait to grab one. I did go for one today, but I missed it. But they're definitely out there. I mean, I've caught two by hand, so they're there, and they're very shallow.
So, when people come out with you on these guided surf fishing trips, Are you kind of shadowing them and giving them tips and pointers as they're fishing? You're obviously doing a little bit of fishing yourself, right next to them, maybe fishing just as much, if not more than them. What's kind of the feel?
It totally depends on the angler, and it also depends a lot on the quantity of anglers. I prefer my ideal situation is one client, that's it, because you can get much more focused there. But two clients is good. Anything more than that gets kind of hectic, unless you're just everybody wants a shark and we can put a couple rods up. But yeah, when it's totally dependent on the angler. If they need a lot of help, I've spent entire sessions not getting a rod in the water for me. If there's three people and if there's kids involved, I'm usually not fishing much unless the dad wants me to hook up and hand the rod to him. For instance, last evening, I had two clients and they were both competent, but yeah, there's always, neither of them had much experience in the surf. So the managing of the line and hook sets are the two things that kind of you have to, at least I like to be there with an angler for at least one bite where I can say, okay, you set it too early, or okay, wait, I see it. Now it's going, set the hook. So I'll spend usually the first 3 hours of a 4 hour session not fishing. And I was just going back and forth between the two of them, depending on whether it was line management, asking some questions and seeing where they were with it, or the hook sets. Like one of them, they both caught, I mean, it was a fantastic day and it ended with a soup fin as they were ready to pack up because I left the rod out there. So that was cool. It totally depends on the client and how competent they are. Cause I've had some sessions where it's like, all right, we're killing it. It's just me and you. And I'll fish the whole time with them. But if there are needs that need to be met, it could be all session with no fishing for sure.
Yeah. And which is great, cause you're actually teaching them how to do it right. And that's a lot of times what people are looking for when they're getting a guide is just, you know, they might have their own gear. They might have an idea that they want to start doing this and they're just trying to cut their teeth and get, you know, experience. And what better way to get experience and go with someone who already has so much experience and the knowledge to share.
Yeah, exactly. And the line management is a huge one too, cause I always explain to them that when you cast out, you're casting in a spot for a reason. So you want to keep it relatively in that area. And with keeping tension, the first thing that people want to do is, okay, it got slack. Let me reel in some line until I have the tension again. You don't always want to do that. Sometimes the wave will push it too far in to the point where you do need to, okay, reel it in to regain tension. But a lot of the time, for every push, there's a pull. And when the wave comes in and you feel a little bit of slack, the best thing to do, I'll stand there right by them and say, okay, raise your rod tip. Raise your rod tip and you'll feel pretty soon the current will pull you back out. And it pulls you back out. You dip your rod tip back to your normal position and you've got perfect tension. You didn't move the weight at all. It's still where you put it. Because you can always move your bait closer to you, but you do not get the opportunity to move it further out very often. So when you are presented that opportunity, I think you take it unless you're already past where you want to be. And that's one that constantly the toughest thing for people to do is they just over reel and before they know it, the bait's by their feet. So little things like that, it's nice to just, I'll stand by them and say, hey, this is what you're doing. And then the other thing would be the hook sets where it's like, you got to wait. I see it so often that the rod tip just shakes a little bit and they just rip into it. It's like, you gotta be patient, but no, it's definitely helpful to kind of just stand by them and walk them through everything without actually doing it yourself. But there is a time when it comes to, okay, watch what I'm doing. See what I did here. Watch how I'm fighting it, stuff like that.
And doing that method where you're raising the rod tip as the wave crashes and dropping the rod tip, I mean, that's going to keep the bait in the most natural presentation as well.
Yeah, I'm sure. I don't know how much fly fishing you've done, but that's totally parallel there. Because if it's not flowing properly, if it doesn't look natural, mm-hmm. It's not going to get bit.
Yeah, totally. I've done quite a bit of fly fishing. I used to tie quite a bit. And one thing I always wanted to do and never did the crossover was fly fish in the surf.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'd be, have you done it yet?
I haven't. I just went to Wyoming this past week and fished the snake and got a few, you know, cutthroat brook trout and then a couple whitefish. And it's fun, but it is frustrating as heck. But I got a rod being the main point. So I'm tempted to bring it out to the surf.
Yeah.
It's just,
I think, you would be surprised at how successful you might be. Cause if you got your cast down and you're accurate, you already know where the fish are and what they're doing.
Yeah.
Now you just need to present a bait in that area. And the hardest part about that is, I guess, having an accurate cast.
Yeah, no, definitely. I'm just curious because obviously I see fly fishermen out there every once in a while, and I have never seen anybody hook up. But that's the same thing that goes, because I think most beachgoers will tell you the same thing. I've never seen anybody catch a fish here. But it's just because I think you're paying attention to what you do and they're paying attention to what they do. But I've definitely been tempted. I just can't imagine it'd be as successful as spinning. Because you're using sand crabs.
You're using live bait.
Yeah. So.
So there's a little more, you know, you're using an artificial. There's special, you know, certain things you got to do. But obviously, guys do it. We see the posts come in and we see the pictures posted. And it was just something I always wanted to do, but never took that leap. I would think a simple gray colored woolly bugger would probably do the job.
And it'd have to be a sinking, right? Like a nymph or something?
Yeah, like a woolly bugger. Yeah.
Oh, is that what it's called?
Yeah. So like a something like that. Or there's also patterns just for the surf. Guys are tying up surf patterns all the time. And I'm sure even down there it's more. There's probably a couple local tackle shops / fly shops down your way that have it all set up.
Yeah. No, it's definitely... I should try it out at least once.
Yeah, just got to find that time.
Yeah, we'd love to do it together.
Yeah.
Look for something to really turn on here, because it hasn't totally turned on yet, and I've got to believe it will.
All right, folks, thank you for listening. This was episode 32 of the Western Outdoor News podcast. For more information on trips, charters, and events that Western Outdoor News is hosting, check out wonews.com. Thanks.